Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's show, we are honored to have Sandy Costa of Smith Anderson Law Firm as our guest. Sandy has over 30 years in executive and senior operating management positions in the pharmaceutical, healthcare, and life science industries. And in addition to his legal practice, Sandy's experience includes president and chief operating officer and vice chairman of Quintiles Transnational Corporation, where he, during his tenure, he had responsibility for all operating decisions, divisions, and worldwide business development. He has other executive level experience as senior vice president of administration, general counsel, and director of Glaxo Incorporated and U.S. area counsel for Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals. Sandy is a nationally recognized speaker on leadership as well as legal and policy issues in the pharmaceutical industry. Sandy, thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Delighted to be here.
So let's talk leadership. We're going to kick off 2014 doing great things in businesses. So what can you clue us in on leadership that you do differently, that you've experienced in your role as an attorney, a board member, and when you were at Quintiles?
Well, I think when I think about leadership, my definition of leadership is to take somebody from one place to another. And I think when you talk about leadership and when I go around the country and speak on the subject, the thing I try to first remind people of is that you can't lead other people unless you can lead yourself. And leadership has to start with assessing yourself and being able to candidly understand, you know, what you're good at and what you're not. We audition every day of our lives, and we're auditioning for the part that we're playing that day. And I tell people that I show a little picture of this airplane. It's an Oronca C-5 that was built in the 1920s, and it would land at about 30 miles an hour. And that meant that if you flew it into a 40-mile-an-hour headwind, it would fly backwards. I saw films of it. It's really quite remarkable. And I think about that when I think of people who assess themselves and how they're doing it being leaders and the like, because they're kind of looking straight ahead and think they're moving at the speed of sound. But if they looked around them at the ground, they'd realize that they're probably flying backwards sometimes and need to work on that. So I think that anything you learn about leadership, even if you're a sole contributor in an organization, will clearly make you more successful. In fact, it's the key to most success that people have. And so I start with that premise that we need to understand that leadership is far more than if you have people in your charge. And it applies to almost any aspect of our lives, business, personal, you name it. And so once we get to that point and think about that, what I have found is we have people who head off to these leadership conferences, and they have all of this corporate speak and leadership speak, and they give you recipes of what you can do to be a great leader. And most people leave there pretty enthusiastically, and if you talk to them a week later, they've probably not subsumed any of that into their daily practices and are just back to doing what they did before. The name of my book is Humanity at Work, and I do think that the types of things I speak about resonate with people because they're more in line with how people are wired. If you think about it, humanity is a manifestation of the natural laws. And so when I speak to people about what they can do to be great leaders by following the rules and or at least the suggestions that I give them, it not only resonates with them, but with just a little bit of practice, a lot of it becomes intuitive. And so right now, Lee, I've been giving talks on trust, primarily on trust, and why it's lacking in the workplace and in our lives generally, or in
society. And in our government and
everything.
Yeah,
and you can pick any aspect of society. And when I start, and I'll be talking to a group tomorrow, the first thing I usually start with is a question, and that is, when was the last time somebody said to you, trust me, and you did? And then I put up a picture of Mother Teresa, and I say, if this woman asked you to trust her, would you? And of course, the answer is yes. I mean, she's a saint in waiting right now. And if you think about the attributes that someone like Mother Teresa had, and I'm not suggesting any of us might get to the level of her devotion to things like humility and compassion and the like. But if you think about the reason you would trust her, they are exactly the same attributes that you could bring into any aspect of your life and be a more trusted leader. And what we're finding now, in my view, particularly on the area of trust, is that an issue that we have now is that there's a huge percentage of employees, huge may be large for some companies, but for many companies, that are completely disengaged. And there would be a time when you would talk about people having exit strategies from companies, but what you would define as an exit strategy today is a lot different than that. My friend Rick Schlenz wrote a great book, Your Employees Have Quit, They Just Haven't Left.
Great title.
Yeah, and he makes the same point, and he does a great job doing that. And that's what's happening. And there's kind of this subsurface paranoia that's taking place with employees, because if you ask them how they are, they're going to say they're fine, they're great, and all of the things you want to hear. Sometimes because I think they're just afraid they couldn't find another job right now. But they are truly missing in action in the workplace. And it, I mean, you don't have to think about it but 20 seconds to realize the huge implications that has for a company in terms of productivity and revenue and the like. You see it also having an effect with the number of work days that people are taking off, sick days, and on and on and on. And so that's how it's manifesting itself in the workplace. And if you think about it, trust, by definition, is a safe place. If you decide to trust me, that's a leap of faith. And so I view trust, it's really kind of a binary process. It's either there or it isn't.
Absolutely.
There's no shades of trust to somebody. And so if you make that leap of faith and decide to trust someone, that's why if something happens which breaches that trust, it really is, I never like to use the word impossible, but it'll certainly never be the same again. And coming to trust the person in some ways just becomes more and more difficult. And we are forgiving people. I mean, that's, I think, one of the attributes that we've been given by our maker. And I think that's important for people to understand. But in the context, we might forgive people, and I think forgiveness is a very, very important factor in our lives.
We can forgive them, but we're not going to forget.
Yeah, you might not forget, and you may not trust them after that. And so I think that's the issue you get into in the context of that. And so if we take trust as that definition that I had about really being something where you've decided to this leap of faith and it's a safe place, you then start thinking about what are the attributes that we should have. One of the talks I give is the four strategies. And when I talk about the four strategies to trust people and for people to trust you, the first thing I start with is, as I said, really having a deep and faithful discussion with yourself about how you're viewed. Are you believable? Are you trustworthy and the like? And then the different attributes that I would think that you need to have. And it really starts, and the first one I think is a lot of fun, with understanding that people are really complex. And in that context, I like to first talk to people about, before we get to the complexities of others, let's think about ourselves, because we're given certain gifts that are important for us to recognize we have and to use. For example, the first thing I would talk about is the fact that we have a free will. We're the only creatures on earth that have been given a free will, and that's a divine gift. And in that context, that means that at any given moment, we can decide how we react to anything that happens in our lives. The problem is some people just abdicate their free will. They don't use it. They don't take responsibility for that. Trusted leaders never give up control of their lives. C.S. Lewis wrote that, you know, some people become playthings of circumstance. And we know people like that. They get thrown into the river and just bobbing around, and they're not trying to swim to shore.
And or so, the wind changes direction,
right,
and they go with it.
That's exactly right. And so first we recognize that we're given that ability, that we're given the ability to manifest at any given moment our own reality. And I tell the story that if you think about the fact that we manifest our own reality, that ad agencies, I mean, what do? They're spending their time trying to have you change your reality as to the products they're peddling. I remember walking down a street one day in Key West, Florida, and it was a sign in this window of this store, and it said, "We buy junk and sell antiques." And so there was a guy who was trying really hard to change your reality as to the products he has. But that is really what does happen. And Gene and I, a number of years ago, had attended a conference on conscious aging. And a doctor got up, and he had spent 30 years studying the lives of people who had lived extraordinarily long lives. And he said after 30 years, and this was just unbelievable, the only difference he could find between people who lived a long life and people who did not is that the long livers had an expectation that they would. And it really does work. Now, that doesn't mean that they might not be hit with a heart attack or some other deadly disease. But what it really means is if you're someone who really doesn't think they're healthy or doesn't take the time to be healthy, you can almost guarantee yourself that you will not live a long life because pessimists are right 100% of the time. And so you start with thinking about the complexities of people and understanding that, and then the emotional complexities. And that's a huge issue for all of us because it's irrational to believe that people will act rationally. It just doesn't happen. I mean, Mark Twain wrote once that the difference between fact and fiction is fiction has to make sense. It has to be rational.
Absolutely.
And it's that, and you just have to kind of roll with the punches, and you have to recognize that the emotional component of our brain is monstrously larger than the rational part of our brain, and you can't intellectualize your emotions. So if someone gets angry, you know, whatever discussion you're having with them at that moment is pretty much over until their emotions subside. And so if I had to sit down and have an important discussion with someone, I would role play before they came in. And what I would say to myself is, would I get angry if someone said this to me? I wouldn't say to myself, would they be sad or disappointed or concerned? Because sometimes you give people news that will do all of those things. Right. You try to do it in a way where, you know, it's
compassionate.
Not, yeah, it's not the intentional infliction of emotional distress, which you get from occasionally from folks. But you just didn't want them to flame out because there's nothing to say at that point. And Coleman talks about that in his book, Emotional Intelligence. He talks about the fact that we have a rational brain and an emotional brain, and that the rational brain is very tentative because it's always looking for more facts. The emotional brain deals in black and white, and that when we get really emotional, really angry, our emotional brain will kidnap our rational brain and have it come up with reasons why it's right. And there's always that illusion of clarity when we get really, really angry. And if you think about it, have you ever gotten infuriated in a situation and had a positive outcome? It just won't happen. And so do I still do that occasionally? Of course, it's the work of a lifetime to try to stop. But it is something that in the context of trying to be a trusted leader, you have to really come to understand the emotional complexities.
Now, someone I talked with a few months ago said, only you can make you angry. It's how you choose to react to somebody,
right,
and your emotions and your defense mechanisms.
It's exactly right. It's this issue of free will. You really make a decision. And I think what we all try to do, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, is that we really just try to roll with the punches sometimes and recognize. And the other thing that happens a lot, of course, if you're dealing with people, and I make these mistakes as well, is that we're so judgmental about folks that, I don't know, you know, maybe it's because I practiced law so long, but, you know, you're always sizing folks up. And I found myself so busy sizing them up that I hadn't bothered to find out the facts about individuals. And what I do now, and it really is a lot of fun and very interesting. I mean, if I meet someone, usually the first thing I'll say to them is, where did you grow up? And if you do that, you can pretty well rest assured that for the next 30 minutes, you won't have to say another word. And it doesn't matter who the person is. Everyone has a great story, a fascinating story. And you find this in the workplace that people come to recognize folks only in what they do in the workplace. And when you find out in most companies, I certainly found this out at Quintiles when I would talk to employees. And Quintiles is, you know, it's just a fabulous company. And its success is, you know, continues. And it's just wonderful to see. But I remember one day I was visiting an office in Sweden, and this woman came up to me who was the goalie on the world champion women's water polo team. World champions.
Wow.
I mean, think about this.
Yeah.
And she was a great employee and dedicated to the company, but she had this other life that was really interesting. And you really need to find these things out about people and learn their stories. And it becomes much easier to deal with folks when you do understand those things. And so the complexities of people in the context of understanding them to be a great leader or a trusted leader are important. And then you talk about the attributes and this of great leaders and trusted leaders. And this kind of comes back to what I was saying before about a Mother Teresa type person, because the types of things that you think about with someone like that and really apply to any great leader or trusted leader are things like humility and compassion and respect for others and
a sort of internal self-knowledge, confidence
right.
in who, and acceptance in who they are, flaws and everything.
That's exactly right. And you find that they're highly self-aware. And when you talk about it, as you just said, flaws and all, understanding themselves, when I see people who are highly self-aware and talk to them, they can tell you that their life is kind of like there's this TV camera shining down on them, and they can view themselves through that camera and objectively grade themselves on how they're doing day to day. It was this issue I brought up before about really, or people understand that they're auditioning every minute. And when they get done at night, they can say, how did I do with my audition today? Because they can stand back from themselves and have this non-grasping awareness. And that's what the important part is, the non-grasping awareness, because there are some days that we just don't do awfully well.
Yes.
And I've always been someone who tells people that on any given day, most of us do the best we can. And some days it's spectacular, the results, and other days it's not so good. So the fact that we didn't do as well one day as another, as long as you felt like you gave it your best shot that day, that's pretty much what anyone can. And if the results don't come out the same, beating yourself up about it serves no purpose at all. And I think that's where self-awareness is such an important thing. I think compassion, as I mentioned, is important. And you have to watch it with compassion, because there's a lot of people in business who think that if you're compassionate towards people, it looks like a sign of weakness. And it isn't. When you're compassionate towards people, it's really a courageous, selfless act. And it is something that people are drawn to, people who are like that. Now, that doesn't mean that people can take you for granted as a leader and that you won't give them the bad news when they need to have it. But it means you'll give it to them in a different way, and you'll expect high expectations from them, because that's what you need, what all of us are being held to, really, in our lives. But it's just the manner in which you do it. And I find that the other thing people forget often is two key points. Is the first one is that, and people laugh when I say this, but they probably haven't thought about it enough, and that is, if you want people to trust you, or if you want to be a great leader, you have to be competent. And people kind of smile the way you are when I said that. And I said, you know, if you go to a doctor and he or she is a great person and you'd love to go to vacation with them or have a drink at a bar, but if you don't think they know what they're doing, you'd never trust them. I mean, I have been in situations with my family where someone came in and it was a year out of medical school or something, and they were going to have this person do one thing or another. And, you know, I turned to them and say, how many times have you done this? 3. And the fella standing next to you, how many times has he done it? 200. Well, I think I'll go with the guy who did it 200. That doesn't mean the other person may not do it well, but it's
odds
the level
are,
of trust.
Yeah,
it's
right.
The level of trust that you
right.
get. And so if you want people to trust you, you better get good at what you're doing. And the other thing that I talk about a lot is candor. And this is a huge issue right now, I think, in most areas of society. It's interesting to me that, you know, we want people who are wax-free and people who are authentic. And we want people who will tell you when they've made mistakes. If you look at these famous people who've had downfalls of one type or another, most of them didn't come from the action they took. It came from the fact that they just couldn't simply stand there and say, I made a mistake, I'm sorry. America's the greatest country on earth. And one of the reasons is that we are the most forgiving people on the planet. And if someone stands up and says, you know, I have the same human fallacies and faults of anyone else, and I'm terribly sorry and I shouldn't have done it, that's pretty much what else. You know, I tell people when folks talk to me and say, what should I say about this issue? I say, well, tell me you made a mistake. And they look at me kind of quizzically for a minute. And then I say, well, what can someone say to you if you said, I made a mistake? Are they going to say you shouldn't have done that? You already know that. And that's a huge issue when you talk about candor in this country, is that we can't get people to simply say, I made a mistake, let's move on. And the other thing that you see in that context is that if leaders are free to say, I made a mistake, or this concerns me, or this frightens me, and people understand those things, from the flip side of that is that in organizations, you know, mistakes happen. And in an operational sense, not in a fiduciary sense, because you have to really try hard not to make mistakes there, and they shouldn't be accepted in many, often, sometimes they can be. But in an operational sense, if the operational side of a company, if the people aren't making mistakes, then they're dead in the water. They're so concerned about the repercussions that they're not going to move the company forward. And so to me, that's a huge area, and one where people have to understand that mistakes can become festering sores. And the other thing that you have to recognize is how you accept a mistake, because what often seems like a mistake from someone in the initial analysis, when they look behind it, they realize that there were truths embedded in that that people don't take.
Right.
And the other thing is that sometimes people, you know, if you fail at an experiment in a lab, somebody will kind of view it in a harsh way. But think about it. When you see these folks who win a Nobel Prize, they went down a certain avenue of research to get to the final goal. But to get there, there were probably scores of people who went down a different area to try to get to the same goal who didn't make it. And if it wasn't for those folks doing that and kind of giving the teachings and learnings of what didn't work up to that point, so although they were obviously not pleased they didn't get to a final goal, the fact was that what they did was a very important consideration in someone who finally reached it. And some people, you know, talk about mistakes in terms where they really aren't mistakes. They were just that people made their best effort at something.
Right. And the outcome just wasn't what was expected based on the criteria and the decisions they made.
And that happens in companies, too, sometimes. That you know, from a strategic sense, you want to do the best you can. But you do have to recognize that there are times when you're not going to get to the goal. And as long as you're satisfied that the best processes possible were put in place, you know, you go from there.
Now, I read about a company, I'm going to say it's been about 6 years, and I don't remember the name of the company, but they had a management philosophy that if you weren't going to make a deadline, the sooner you told somebody that you had an issue, so you were expected to meet your commitments, but if you weren't and you needed extra help or something was gone wrong, the earlier you told them,
absolutely,
the better off the result was going to be, because people could pitch in.
Well, I think that's exactly right. The other thing is that most of us, I mean, we are intensely social beings, and relationships are important. And in the context of relationships, I think the thing you find is that we want to please people. And we want to please people so much that if something's going to take us 2 weeks and they need it in a week, we don't want to tell them we can't do it in a week. And in the context of having people trust you, one of the biggest issues is managing expectations. And it actually works both ways, managing the expectations of others and actually managing your own expectations. Because what sometimes happens is that we will give people directives, but we haven't really been very clear. We think we've been clear. And then we get upset when the directive wasn't followed through on. But the fact is that we're not managing our own expectations, because it really is a function of the fact that we didn't give a clear directive. And sometimes you'll see that at the end of the day. And you have to recognize that in that case, the fault lies with you and not with the other person.
Well, leadership, relationships, that's all about communication. Trust is about communication.
Absolutely.
I read something about the three things we expect from our leaders is that we can trust them, they give us a sense of security, and they give us hope that there's a good outcome out there, that the relationship's going to continue,
absolutely,
all of those types of things.
No, I think that's exactly right, because if you think about hope, for example, I do talk about the fact that I think that great leaders and trusted leaders choose faith over fear. And it's a little circuitous getting there, but just stick with me. And the point I make is that the problem, the reason why trusted leaders are fearless is not because they don't have fear come into their lives, but because they have the courage to try and examine the facts that are causing the fear. Most of us kind of just hunker down and hope it'll blow over. And then with no facts to deal with, the demons up there and between our ears take over, and they'll come up with scenarios that are worse than anything can happen in your life. And so fear will evaporate when facts come on the scene. But in the context of that, you know, you think about people having faith, and there's two types of faith in my view. There's spiritual faith, and then there's the faith we have in each other. Because once again, if you don't have faith in others, you can never expect them to have faith in you. If you don't trust someone, they will never trust you. But in the context of faith, I think that when you were talking about hope, that's important. Because if you have faith in somebody, that faith will spawn hope. And I told people, I think my favorite passage on the subject of hope was by St. Paul in his letter to the Romans, where he said, adversity produces endurance, endurance produces character, character produces hope, and hope never disappoints. But when you think about hope never disappointing, and you think of the words that Paul spoke or wrote, when he talks about things like character and endurance and the like, what he's saying is that hope is not a passive emotion. I spoke out in Las Vegas 2 years ago at the Toastmaster International Worldwide Convention, which was a big honor. I had a wonderful time doing it. And I remember telling the audience, if you're going to sit in your hotel room and start this mantra, I hope I win $1 million tonight, I hope, that's not going to do it.
Hope requires action.
It requires a will in the way to get something done. And so faith leads to hope, and then hope with action to try and action what you're trying to get to is how it will come about. That doesn't mean miracles don't happen when, you know, we're in dire straits. And frankly, there's nothing but a miracle that can bring something to the conclusion you would hope with when we have family that's terribly ill and things of that sort. But you do need to have the will and the way to get something done.
So if you had to tell the listeners three things that they could do to change how they're perceived and their impact as a leader, what three things would that be?
Well, the first one is, and this may be the most important, I certainly think humility is at the top of the list. I think that humility is the sire of all virtues. And I genuinely don't believe there's ever been a great man or woman, a great leader, who wasn't humble. Humility is a great teacher, and people who are humble have a quiet certitude about themselves. When they do something outstanding, they look like they've been there before. They let other people speak to what they've done rather than themselves. And to me, there is no question that humility is right at the top of the list. And I think the second thing, and this is very, very important in my view, and it's something when you talk about society today and the problems we see, and that is that your actions have to line up with your words. I think it was Jim Croce in one of his songs who said, it's what you do makes you what you are. And it's amazing because we see people in the political and business world that say one thing to their constituents and then do another. And the thing I always find interesting about that is that some people think, if I just do this little thing, people will never find out about it or they won't pick it up. And of course they pick it up. I mean, it always comes out. And so there is just no question that is the second most important thing that you can do. And that is to make sure, because when I used to take on additional responsibilities at one of the companies I was at, I remember I used to go in and see the employees and of a department that I picked up, and I'd start waxing ecstatic about my management philosophies and leadership. And it took me one or two times to realize everyone was tuning out. And after that, when I had another department that I took on, I literally would go in and say, look, I can stand there and talk to you about how I feel about things, but you're going to judge me by the first thing I do. And so, you know, stay tuned and you can decide from what I do and how you view me in, as a leader. And so to me, that is absolutely very important. And in that context also, I'd make the point that leaders, and that's all of us, people are watching you every minute. They'll watch the way you butter your bread. And so our actions are the sole barometer by which many people will judge who we are. And it's probably right, because that's the most objective way that people can determine. And far more than what we say, it's the actions that we take. And I guess the third point I make, and this is, it may seem a little off topic, but I think it's important, and that is that we really need to have mercy on ourselves. we just, Stephen Levine writes about this, about the fact that we never treat other people the way we treat ourselves. If you think about it, if someone comes to you and says they made a mistake, and I mean, it could be a mistake that, as long as they haven't made the same mistake three or four times, and what do we say to them? Glad you told me. It could have been a festering sore. Now we can take care of it, on and on and on. But when we make a mistake, we just fillet ourselves. And there's a book called The Four Agreements. And one of the points, that I can't remember the author's name, I think it was Diaz, but he talks about the fact that we're a society of justice. And what he means by that is that in our society, if you commit a transgression, you're punished. But you're only punished once for each transgression. Well, I can conjure up something I did 10 years ago and can bring it to life like it happened 10 minutes ago and then fillet myself all over again. It's not going to happen.
I know one of the things I've been focused on is only looking forward, right? So I can't do anything about what I've done in the past or what yesterday was.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. It's looking forward into today and tomorrow, the next minute, doing
That's
the
right.
best I can. And don't waste time and energy looking back on what I did at 23. I wasn't the same person at 23 that I am at 49.
Lee, you know, when people say folks live in the past, it's a nonsensical statement. You can't live in something that doesn't exist. It no longer exists. The only opportunity we have to change anything in our lives is what's happening right now, in the present.
Right.
And do we all look back and kind of fillet ourselves about us? Absolutely. But I think certainly in my case, the older I get, while I'm still not great at that, I do realize that you just have no control over that. There's nothing you can do about it now.
When it's like that little voice starts in your head and just like, shut up.
Yep.
I'm not going to listen. I'm thinking about what I'm going to do tomorrow and how great that's going to be.
That's right. And the other thing is that when we do something that seems like a negative or a mistake, how often is it, and it happens a lot, that something down the road comes along and you say to yourself, If the thing I was so upset about it happened, I would have never had this opportunity. And I'm sure there's no one listening who hasn't been there. I had an opportunity for a job position once that I did not get, and I was terribly upset about it. And a month later, I was given one of the biggest opportunities of my life. And it was the same thing. If I had taken this job, it would have been, you know,
right.
It would have paled in significance to the good fortune I had a month later. And we constantly do that we take something as being bad news and, you know, let it sit there a while before you decide it's bad news.
Yeah.
Because it's very interesting what happens with people.
Well, even when you make a mistake. So I know when I started my company 11 years ago,
right.
I ended up doing a joint venture with a couple other people. And I got burned from that. But next week I'm talking about strategic relationships, what to expect, how to look at what's in the agreements, how to do that kind of thing. And I tell people now, if you couldn't trust them without an agreement,
right.
You can't trust them with an agreement.
Correct. No, I don't think there's any question about that. I've always felt that, I mean, good lawyers can draft great agreements, but the only thing that makes agreements really work is a large dose of goodwill on both sides. But what you're saying is important about, you know, the things you've learned in the past, and I mean, there are some lessons we get in our lives that are really, really painful. But the thing we forget is that all of life is experiential. I mean, the only thing we have to draw on are our life experiences. And I feel that there comes a point in our life where we have all these life experiences, and we then are able to bring a sense of understanding of what these experiences meant in relationship to our lives. And we take that understanding and we bottle it up. Or bundle it up, I should say. And that's what wisdom is. Wisdom is taking an understanding of what's occurred in the past and bundling it up, and it becomes the wisdom of who we are. I'm in Thoreau and Walden, he has a wonderful passage where he built his little shack. There was an owl that lived in the tree just above him, and he'd look out at that owl at night, and he said, when I looked in his face, he appeared to have a wisdom clarified by experience. And that's what all wisdom is. It's all life experiences. And so if you can do this, and it's not easy sometimes, God knows, but if you can say to yourself at night, if you went through something that was harsh or negative, I've learned something from it. you know, does it hurt? Does it cut down on the pain? Probably not. That's got to kind of run its course. But it does teach you that, you know, there's a lot of things in our lives that are going to be painful and not what we wanted. But you'll learn a lot from that, and probably more than you will when you succeed.
Things go well. Yeah. You know, and you think about it, parents try to tell their kids from their experience and their wisdom, and the kids don't listen, right? We have to learn it on our own. So we get the scars, we fall down, we have to get picked up. I kind of think we're in a mode in society now that we're not letting people fall down and get up, bandage it up, let them go on and try walking again or riding that bike again or whatever it is.
That's right.
In the workplace, people are afraid of failure because of the consequences, because it's always a negative reaction. It's
not at all companies.
Yeah, that's true. But it's, you know,
the great companies, that I don't think that it is quite that way. And it really kind of goes a little bit from who your supervisor is in different circumstances. But no, I understand. And I think you're absolutely right about what happens with our children. And that's a tough one. I mean, you know, I've always been very paternalistic towards my family, and I'm no better than anyone else at wanting them not to feel pain. But I think in the educational systems, you're right that we do have a circumstance where we shield our families now. And like I said, I'm not particularly good at that either. I guess there's no bum like a reform bum. But there is that circumstance. But they do learn from us, children. And once again, when I was talking about learning from our experiences more than our words, I mean, my dad was a dress manufacturer. He was a terrific guy. He ran his own dress manufacturing business in the garment district in New York City. And my dad got up at 5 o'clock every morning. He was out of the house by 5:45, and he'd come home 8 o'clock at night. And did he have to tell me that you had to work hard to succeed? No.
I mean, you saw him working hard to succeed.
Just that he was a very charitable, compassionate man. And when I talked to him about that, it's really actually interesting. In my book, I talk about my dad a lot. And he was you could walk down the street with him in the garment district. And he was a tough businessman. I mean, it's a difficult way to make a living. And he would be walking along, and there'd be people asking for handouts. And he would be talking to you as he was putting his hand in his pocket to take out some money to hand off to people. And he never lost his train of thought. He never stopped talking. It was completely reflexive. Well, I never really asked him, you know, why he did that. And then one day he was telling me about his father, my paternal grandfather, who I never met. He had passed on before I was born. And he was a shoemaker. He had 7 kids. They were dirt poor. And my father told me that during the Depression, he could not remember a night where there wasn't a stranger at the dinner table that my grandfather had brought home to feed. He told me a lot of other funny stories. He told me that my grandmother would not give my grandfather the money to go pay the electric bill.
Because by the time he got there, it'd be gone.
He'd give it away, and then they'd turn the lights off once or twice because he'd given the money to people who were in need. And so did his father tell him that he had to be charitable? No. He just watched him. He learned that from him, and I hope I learned in some small measure the same thing from my dad. But that's the influence that parents really have. I think there's important lessons that you have to say to people, but the ones that we remember the most are the ones that really come from their actions and deeds.
Yeah, my dad was a man of integrity, and he was a civil engineer, a land surveyor.
Right.
And my great aunt had a flower shop, and she had moved, and she started getting a property line dispute with her neighbor. Well, Dad surveyed it, put the pins in, and the neighbor was correct. And my aunt expected him to move pins, and Dad goes, no, this is the way it is. And she, well, your family. And he goes, but I'm not changing it for anyone. And
right.
So he ended up going and pulling the pins and saying, okay, just do whatever you guys are going to do, but this is, and I can remember how angry she was for years. And I can also remember the lady that he did right by, Mrs. Meadows, that she had so much respect for my dad.
Sure.
And everybody in the community did, because they know when he did something, when he said something.
Right.
His word was his bond. You could count on him. And that reputation does so much, and knowing that you can't compromise.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, one thing I try to remind people of is that there's a lot of definitions of success. And in our society, sometimes it's tied to material wealth or influence and power and prestige that people have and the like. But if you really thought about what would be the greatest indices of success, certainly near the top of the list would be for anyone, that they were a trusted individual. If you're someone that people genuinely trust, there could be few measures of success that would be greater than that.
Well, if we look at our times, what leaders would you point out today, two or three? Who are you, if you can find two or three? Do you think you see them out there and they're doing true leadership? They're competent. They're doing the things that make them successful.
Oh, let me start by saying I think there's a lot of them out there. And so while I think that we have issues of trustworthiness that we have to work on, I'm not someone who's kind of given up the ship and think that, you know, all of that there's a disaster brewing. Is there an issue in the workplace with a lot of these people? I think there is. But I am someone who is supremely optimistic about, you know, our country per se, and the fact that, there's still many, many people out there that you could turn to. In the context of picking two or three people, that's interesting because I'd have to kind of think about that a minute, Gene. Lee, I'm sorry. I was
that's
thinking.
Okay. You can look at, I couldn't pull one out of the political realm right now. I can think of things that they've said or their actions. And like you said, we judge by actions. And one of our fearless leaders in politics, I saw her stand up in front of the microphone and say, well, that was a campaign promise and nobody expects you to keep a promise, right? And so
I
was driving here today for the interview and I'm thinking, can I think of a single political leader that I would say I trust, that binary, I trust, I don't trust. I have some that I'm waiting to determine my opinion.
Right.
Because I need to see some actions. But it's kind of hard. I mean, I can look around at the ones that are successful leaders. Jack Welch, right?
Right.
We have him as an icon. But to some extent, he's not current. He's not leading an organization right now.
Right.
Donald Trump, pluses and minuses, successful. But I'm not so sure about the humility part of the definition. And you just look around and you see people leading organizations privately, that people whose names no one would know. I could call those leaders.
Oh, I think there's lots of them there. I think even in the political spectrum, I just don't spend enough time looking at that I could sit down and grade people. But I suspect that there's a lot of people in politics who are trying to do the right thing day in and day out. I don't sit down and kind of grade what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. So I think they're around. But one thing you point out when you talk about people that are no longer in positions of influence, the one thing I do recommend to people is that they find people that they think are great leaders and they read as much as they can about them. And so, for example, I've always thought that Lincoln was the greatest leader of the 19th century, without a doubt in my mind. And I've read just about anything you could find on the man, and it really is remarkable, the attributes he had. He also had flaws like any of us, of course. I think that you can make people into a deity, and he would kind of chuckle at that if he was alive today.
Well, look how many times he failed before he became running for office.
That's exactly right.
President.
He really failed at virtually every elected position he had tried to get before he became president. But there's a huge amount that can be learned from people like that. And Churchill in the 20th century was a giant. But
Margaret Thatcher
was huge. I mean, and you could go back, people like Mother Teresa and Madame Curie and, just on and on with people who were, showed the right traits, and Albert Schweitzer. And you can just, and you'll see that, I think you'll see that most of them had the types of attributes that I was talking about for a trusted leader. One of my favorites is Ernest Shackleton. I don't know if people who've read as much as they can about him. Shackleton was an Antarctic explorer. And he goes down as my second greatest leader of the 20th century. And if you he went to Antarctica on a boat called the Endurance, and if you look up Endurance of Shackleton, you can his adventure story is one of the greatest ever. It is, in fact, when you read it, it's hard to imagine that it's actually true. It does read like fiction what these guys went through. But anyhow, he went down to the Antarctic. He had been with Scott on several of his Antarctic expeditions, and he goes down in this boat, and the boat is caught up in the ice, and there were 28 men in a stowaway on the boat, and they have to get off, and they're literally on an ice floe now with two small boats, 20-foot boats, and 28 men. And the rest of the story is how they're all saved eventually, and it is just an incredible story. But when I think of great leaders, one of the stories I took away, I was talking before, Lee, about how our actions have to line up with our words. And Shackleton was Irish, but he had been in the British Navy. And before he went away on this expedition, he was given a Bible by the King of England. I think it was George V at the time. I'm not certain. But he literally handed him this Bible, and all the men knew this Bible meant the world to him. So they're on this ice floe now, and Shackleton turns to them and says, "We can only take with us what is absolutely essential." And he takes out the Bible. He rips out one page, one of his favorite Psalms, sticks it in his pocket, and he throws the Bible in the snow. And that's the way a great leader operates. He doesn't say, "We can only take what's absolutely necessary, of course I'm going to take everything I need." I mean, that is the sign of a great leader. And it's quite a story. I'd recommend it to anyone to read if they don't know about it.
We'll have to get that.
Yeah, it's just a great story.
So if you looked back over your career, who were the most influential leaders over the course of your developing your style and your skills?
Well, I think there had been a fair number of them. I think, you know, you're really talking to the subject of mentorship and how we find mentors. And when I'm asked about that from people and how to find mentors, what I tell them is, you know, you can be mentored in a lot of different ways, but if you want somebody who's really going to be a mentor who's with you for a fair amount of time and has some influence on you, I tell people to make sure to find somebody who actually knows them and knows about them, because we take actions every day when we're trying to be leaders. And a lot of times the action, let me see how I can put this. It kind of revolves around our life experiences. And so unless somebody really understands you to that extent, when you take some action, unless they can put in there the component that really reflects, you know, what your past experience has been in the workplace or in your home or whatever it might be, it's difficult for them to give, I think, meaningful advice to you, because if they look at it in a vacuum, it kind of becomes this was right or this was wrong, rather than I kind of understand why he did this because of his background and experiences. That doesn't mean he shouldn't change it, but it kind of goes less to the judgment per se and more towards what your life experiences have been again. And so when I think back on people who have helped me, I really, you know, think back on some lawyers that I've worked with inside of corporations I've been with, some CEOs I've worked for, and I've been very fortunate that I've never been involved with a CEO in any of the companies I've been at who wasn't an outstanding person and someone I learned a lot from. So I've really been gifted that way in all the companies I've worked for. And in the context of that, I really think, you know, a lot of them were mentors in a lot of important ways without me knowing it. I had one man, I'll give you a quick story, give you an idea of this. I had a fellow, and he's passed on now, a wonderful man, a lawyer in Washington, and he was a mentor to me in a very real sense. And I remember calling him up one day, and I had been made this job offer, and it was a terrific job offer. And I call him up on the phone, and I'm reading to him, and he's listening. I'm reading to him from the letter I got, the offer letter, and he's listening. And so then we get to the part about the compensation, and I start to whine. And I'm saying, golly, I thought it would be more, and I thought it would be this number, and I don't understand why. And my mentor was just listening to me, and when I got done, it was a little silence on the phone, and he said, "Sandy, did you ever think that's what you're worth?" I said, "I'll sign the letter and send it in tomorrow." And I mean, that's what you need mentors for, is to kind of bring you back to earth and say,
reality, you know, check.
Yeah, reality checks, besides telling you, you know, giving you advice of all others. It's kind of bringing you back and pulling you out of your ego and into the real world.
My mom has a way of assessing that. She says, "I'd like to buy them for what they're worth and sell them for what they think they're worth."
Right.
Right, because our perceptions.
Oh, and we all do it.
Yes.
And, you know, it's important to feel you're worthy. I mean, when I t- talk about these subjects, and the word worthy comes up, because if you really, if you want to be a great leader, one place to start is to recognize that the most important two things to anyone is that they feel respected, that they feel they're a person of worth, and that what they do is meaningful. And if you can help people feel truly respected and worthy, and that what they do is meaningful, there's virtually nothing they won't do for you constructively. I mean, people, that is, those are the people, when you talked about mentors and all, or people you've worked for, it's people who give you a sense of self-worth and help you do meaningful things, because there's, that really is kind of near the top of the list of what's the most important thing to any individual. And
but no one externally is going to give you that. If you don't do that work up front that you were talking about at the beginning of the show, if you don't feel, if you're not filled with your confidence, know what you're confident at, know what you're good at, and you're always down on yourself and looking at the mistakes.
Absolutely.
No one can make you feel worthy.
No, that's, I think,
but they can help build that from a foundation.
No, but the flip side, but there are people who can tear you down.
Yes.
I mean, if a leader makes a person feel worthy and is respected.
Valued.
And for example, when you think about showing your respect to someone, one of the things I'll talk about often is that if you want someone to know that you respect them, prepare for meetings. We've all been to meetings where it's an important meeting. It's about your salary or a promotion or about your performance. And, you know, for 2 or 3 days, you've been talking to your spouse about it because it's a big deal to you. And you walk in the room and your supervisor is staring at the ceiling saying, "Well, John, I'm glad you came in today." And it takes 30 seconds to realize this person hadn't given 30 seconds thought to the meeting and what we were talking about. And what does that say to people? This person doesn't respect me. This is an important deal, and they haven't taken the time to prepare. And so it's things like that when you talk about, there are things you have to do for yourself, but there's so much we can do for others to make them understand that we respect them and hold them as somebody that's worthy.
Well, I think if we have a negative filter in place or a positive filter, what comes in gets, you know. I remember having a supervisor when I was at major corporations, and I went to work for him. He gave me a performance review, I'm going to say 4 months in. The guy that was supposed to have trained me never trained me. I hadn't had a conversation with my supervisor in those 4 months.
Right.
And I just kind of looked at him and was like, "What?" And he's like, "Well, you haven't done this." And I'm like, "Well, considering I'm training myself and rebuilding everything, I'm thinking, okay, whatever." A year later, still not a good relationship with that supervisor. And when we came in for the review, I decided I was giving him a review. And he was shocked. I was like, "You never check to see what we're doing. You always don't want anything progressing." You know, went through. He's like, "Is that how you see me?" I was like, "Yeah, that's how I see you." And then he had to step back and redo the performance review from the standpoint of, like you said, what wasn't he doing?
Right.
And he was not engaged with anyone on his team.
Right.
He didn't get involved in analysis. He didn't get involved in modeling. And so it's knowing, okay, I'm doing the best every day. I'm in here 14-hour days, 16-hour days, 7 days a week. If I'm giving my best, then, and it's not what you're wanting, it's because you didn't communicate what you want, or you don't even know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it's those learning experiences,
sure,
of owning that career and having the confidence to know I'm competent. I'm doing great work, and other people are acknowledging it. And he just didn't have an understanding of it. And I think, again, that's when you come in, somebody's been in that same position for 30 years. You know, lower middle management.
Right.
And then you're coming in, and I was in an executive training program, and I came in, and I can look back and think now, from my age I am now, it was probably pretty intimidating for him to come in, for me to come in and have computer skills and spreadsheet skills and all this stuff, which was something he had never worked with in his career.
Yeah.
And it was just a whole different world, and everything was leaving him behind.
Yeah.
And that's, I had to develop that compassion in hindsight for him.
Right. And I think that's right. Because it is, you know, in the best self-help book ever written is How to Win Friends and Influence People, in my view, Carnegie's book. And one of the points he makes in that book is that you don't have to be the best engineer to run the engineering department. And I think people need to understand that, is that it's important to surround yourself with absolutely the best people you can get. People trust folks who bring in really high performers around them. I mean, if you read The Prince by Machiavelli, what's he talk about? You judge the prince by who he surrounds himself with. And I think about that a lot because, you know, it was never difficult for me to find people that were smarter than I was and surround myself with them. And to me, it's such a positive reflection on you if you can do that. And so, yeah, I think if you look back on it, the fact that he took to heart what you had said, you know, was a really positive point for him and one worth remembering. Yeah.
It was just this, you know, a light one. I was like, well, I'm not going to take this. I'm going to frame it. I've spent weeks coming up with what I was doing. And I had such a positive perception outside of our little work group, and even within the work group, except for him. But outside, you know, there'd be times I would do a project for another area, and I would come back and tell, you know, this is the way it works. And I'd say, that's not how it works. And I remember going to one of the guys that was sort of a mentor to me and telling him, Jim, I need you to come and meet with everybody, all the management here, because they say, I don't know what I'm talking about. He goes, you built the model. I was like, yeah, but they still say that that's not the way it works.
Yeah.
And so he literally came up, and his last name was Bolts. They called him Thunderbolts because when he took off, he got rolling. And he came up, and he was there maybe 5 minutes. He goes, I'm wasting my time having to do this. But because she needs me to do it, I'm going to tell you, I'm coming here to tell you, she knows what she's doing. She understands it. She built the model. She's been helping us do this.
Right.
You need to listen to her because she's the only one up here that knows what's going on.
Right.
And it just, the room was dumbfounded.
Yeah.
And they're like, what do you mean you built the model? I said, I built the model in my spare time because they needed it and they didn't have the skill set.
Right.
And so I stepped up good for the company to do this. And it was just a mind-boggling thing for them to know that I had been doing things to help other people.
Right.
That wasn't in my job description just because they needed the help.
Yeah.
Right.
See, I think one of the things, and I take this as a positive actually, is that at the time that you were talking about that chronologically, and even when I first began my career, which was long before you did, Lee, in those days, people were promoted because of their technical competence. It was all technical competence. If you were the best engineer, you got promoted. And I think more and more, and I take this as an encouraging sign, people recognize now that that's not the end all and be all. I'm back to the point about you don't have to be the best engineer.
Right.
You have to be somebody who can lead the department. And I think more and more companies have come to realize that. As I said, I really am upbeat that things are getting better, much better, and from where they might have been 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And I can remember what they were like back then because I was practicing law then. But so I'm really kind of encouraged. And when we talk about the types of attributes people need to be great leaders, I'd never want to leave the inference that I think that there aren't lots of them out there, because there are lots of them out there.
I run into a lot of them every day.
Every day. And, you know, for people who are trying to get better at what they do, my suggestions are really to help them, because there's not one of us, myself included, who, you know, as Dupre says in one of his books, Max Dupre, you know, like companies, people are always a state of becoming. And so that's, you know, probably how it end.
That's great. Thank you for sharing your insights. And I hope we'll have you back for more on another show.
Be delighted. Thank you. It was great fun.
Thanks.